You are listening to the Professional Education Broadcast Network. Thank you for joining us for Healthcare Issues and Estate Planning. I'm pleased to introduce our speakers. Joining us from Tampa, Florida is William Kalish. Mr. Kalish is a partner with Johnson, Pope, Boker, Ruppel & Burns, LLP, where his practice focuses on advising individual clients and their families on their estate and trust plans, including wills, revocable trusts, irrevocable trusts, charitable trusts, private foundations, and limited partnerships. He is a fellow of the American College of Tax Counsel and formerly served as chair of ABA Tax Section. Mr. Kalish will serve as the discussion leader of today's program. Also joining us from Tampa, Florida is Jeffrey Gadd. Mr. Gadd is a partner with Johnson, Pope, Boker, Ruppel & Burns, LLP, where his practice, focusing on representing individuals, emphasizing a broad range of probate, business and taxation-related issues. His practice integrates the personal and estate tax planning concerns of individuals with tax and business planning for their closely held businesses. Mr. Kalish, I hand the program over to you.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to have Jeff work with me and for this session. He and I have adjacent offices, and the matters that we're going to cover today are things that we deal with on a regular basis. And one of the good things about having somebody else that's that close by is that we bounce ideas off. Even as we were preparing our presentation, we talked about recently with clients in the last 3 days on exactly some of these issues that we will probably mention during the course of the day. But we're going to talk about what I generally collectively call ancillary documents, and those are living wills, healthcare directives, durable powers of attorney, and related documents. They have different names in different states, but the intention is to have clients focus on making decisions that will be for what they want, but won't be able to communicate them other than these documents and whatever they tell the people that will carry them out. The interesting thing about estate planning, it starts as early as when anybody does start and pretty much ends, depending on how trusts go, a long way off, and it's a work in process. For lawyers, it is a very good idea, if possible, of course, to remain in contact with estate planning clients, because knowing your client and knowing your client's family is critical to drafting these kinds of documents and understanding how families change and what the impact is. And as lawyers, we tend to be able to hear, for example, that an adult child, if you will, has developed diabetes, and he's been named as a healthcare surrogate and the financial trustee, without really thinking through how much burden that's going to be and what impact it'll have. And those are the kinds of things that are so important as we go through trying to figure out what we need to do and how to help clients plan. Typically, when clients walk through the door and they want to have estate plan, and they want to say, I want to make sure that I want to have documents prepared so when I go into the hospital, everybody will know what I'm doing. And that's all they really know, other than what they read in the newspaper or hear stories about or what they see on television. It's our responsibility to have the client really discuss with us the people that are close to them and really what they want to do, and those things change from time to time. Indeed, 2 days ago I met with clients. The husband is 89 and the wife is 87. They're both healthy, look much younger, and they want to make sure that they remain in their condominium. They do not; they have enough money where they want home care. And to a point, they have four lovely children, and one of the ways of making sure that they will, all four children have to agree if the time has come that they need to go into an assisted living facility. So those are the kind, those kinds of things pop up all the time, and if you, it's so important that you know your client that well. I think we should really start talking of how do we counsel our clients? What do we want our clients to think about? What are those things that influence them for their preferences? If it's in the healthcare area, do they want to have the hospital and the physicians do everything possible, even if they are? I assume everybody has heard of the Terri Schiavo case. It's an important one in Florida. That woman was in a vegetative state with no hope of recovery and was in that condition for many years. And it took about 3 years of litigation to do something that didn't make, that they could have easily been handled if the people had thought about it. A lot of people have made help in reaching those decisions. Often their religion makes a difference. So it's important for the lawyer to know and ask the question if there are ethical, moral, or religious issues that may impact on their preferences, because that will help us carry on. I'll give an example with respect to cancer treatment. Does it make sense to go through serious radiation when somebody is rather aged and has serious heart conditions, to go through all of that pain, and assuming that the person isn't obviously not healthy with cancer? It's a lot better asking that client when they're 45 or 50 and take notes in your file about what their answers are, and keep it in mind as time goes on. I think sometimes we can go online with Google and sort of do it yourself kind of thing, and think that makes sense. At some level, each state may have their own set of laws and rules, and what appears in how someone has phrased it may not really be what the client wants. I know Jeff is going to talk about a client that he met with not too long ago, and really focused on details that were very important. Jeff, why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, thanks, Bill, and hi everyone. There are, that was a good overview, I think, of just some general considerations. Let me dive right into some of the details. I'm going to cover some of the drafting considerations, and there's some important themes and considerations that go into the drafting, and some of them are personal preference. I'm going to tell you, as an attorney that's been practicing now 18 years, I've seen any number of different ways that the ancillaries, as Bill described them earlier, can be drafted. Personal preference will be my guiding point for purposes of this discussion. For instance, there are times where you will see a power of attorney and healthcare surrogate blended into a single document, and to me that is a big mistake. I think from a drafting standpoint, I'm all about saving trees. I like to save paper when possible, but they really need to be separated, certainly in Florida and I think most other states, because they serve very different functions. A durable power of attorney takes effect in Florida immediately, and I think in most states that's the case. And it really is intended more for financial assistance and other instructions that are provided for in that specific document. When it comes to healthcare surrogates, however, that is strictly medical. And that also, at least in Florida, comes up when the person is incapacitated, which is different than a power of attorney. So right there, you've got some significant distinctions between what the documents provide, how they come about, and what their purposes are. One financial, one is medical. And, you know, time and again, I'll see them blended together, and it's a bit of a pet peeve of mine. And so I think one important lesson from a drafting standpoint is to separate those documents and make sure that they're that they're covering the intended purpose of what they're designed for. With respect to a healthcare surrogate, I tell clients this is probably the simplest document we prepare because as a practical matter, the document doesn't really change one client to the next. Sometimes you'll have specific instructions from a client, you know, to include something or to remove something. But for the most part, they tend to be fairly standard, you know, compliance with state law and compliance with HIPAA. And HIPAA is really the game changer when it comes to these discussions. I mean, without a healthcare surrogate, you're really left to, you know, if especially for non-married individuals, you're really left to guardianship as the principal way to be able to communicate on behalf of a relative, friend, or loved one. And you really need that document in order to assist the medical providers with having a means of communicating. And so that really lends special importance to some of these documents. Even, you know, even the term ancillary doesn't do it justice, because this could mean life and death for clients, which is pretty significant when you think about the potential consequences of not having one of these, you know, something in place that's signed, witnessed, and notarized. And so, you know, I think you want to emphasize them, but you also want to separate them, as I mentioned. You also need to understand the distinctions between them. A living will is really, in my professional opinion, a living will should be separate from a healthcare surrogate. When I prepare my living wills, I make sure that the same individuals that are named in the healthcare surrogate are also named in the living will so that you are avoiding conflict. And I also tend to go with a single person when it comes to drafting for purposes of making medical decisions as opposed to multiple individuals. I do that to try to avoid a conflict, especially where you've got, you know, significant medical decisions that need to be made in a timely manner and you've got two people that can't agree. One maybe wants to move forward with the doctor's recommendation. Another one is saying, no, let's find another doctor. The other thing is sometimes the second person or, you know, third person even may not be available. And then, you know, what do you do? And even if there's language in your healthcare surrogate that provides for what happens if, you know, if you don't have a majority assembled or if you can't locate someone, you're leaving it up to a medical provider to read a legal document, which is never a good thing. I think that you know, it should be fairly clear, straightforward, and who are you naming and in what priority. When it comes to powers of attorney, different story, probably even a different presentation. That opens up a whole other can of worms, but in that instance, it may not be a bad idea to have multiple people named as a check and balance.
And that's why it's so important to know family and know
correct.
People, because different people can serve different functions.
Yeah.
And you really need to be careful who gets along, who doesn't get along, and that's very important.
Yeah. And that's very, I mean, that really is the central theme of all of this, is first know your client, and from the client's perspective, know your family or your friends. Who is going to serve in these roles? Do you trust them implicitly, and will they make the proper decisions?
And it's also very imperative that you stay in contact with the client, follow up every so often, because people change, they move somewhere else, there are tragedies, families, they can't be able to serve, and important. And frankly, clients know it's important, and they'll say, "Oh, I'll call up Jeff tomorrow." And then,
yeah.
So everything is fine until something isn't, and then.
That's right. You want to have, and this is laying the foundation for that rainy day, if you will. Other drafting considerations, and we can also maybe even call this Jeff's pet peeves. I think that it is very important from a drafting perspective to, and again, you see this, it's common, you see burial instructions that are oftentimes placed in a will. And in my mind, I think it's important to have a separate instruction for interment. And the reason for that is wills aren't always accessible. And, you know, we talk in the materials about religious and personal preferences and what impact that has from a drafting standpoint. And that has obvious implications on everything that we're talking about today. But even from a timing standpoint, you have certain religions that require interment within 24 hours of passing. And the worst thing is you're not aware as a family member of a special instruction in a will. You don't have a copy of the will, and you discover the will a week later, you know, after you reach out to the attorney and you get a copy of the will, and you read in the second paragraph, "Oh, those are the burial instructions, and we just messed up."
I know that what Jeff and I do, and different people have different views of it, but the way we've been practicing is that we hold on to the original, we give copies to clients, and we make sure that the client tells their family members if there's a problem that ever comes up, call Bill or Jeff. We have the same assistant. We know the hospital's here, so if they're going into the hospital and that's the worst time for people to start looking for their documents, they're all here. We know all the hospitals. We know who to send. We know who, Jeff just said, the funeral instructions. We know where they are, and clients don't have to worry about it. By and large, a lot of clients will think the safest place is to put in the safe deposit in a bank. That's the worst place.
Well, and as a corollary to that, some clients are not comfortable sharing their will and or trust with their beneficiaries or their heirs or their or even the named fiduciaries. But they may be more comfortable sharing the ancillaries, especially a healthcare surrogate and certainly instructions for interment. So to me, it jumps out a little bit more, and it avoids you know, really uncomfortable decisions that need to be made if you bury the loved one in the wrong place.
We had that issue not too long ago.
Yeah.
And also in Florida, because the durable power of attorney is I really don't like originals or copies floating around at the client because they're live documents.
That's right. So, just as a practical matter, you'll see in the materials there are different discussion points about, you know, coma versus persistent vegetative state. When does a living will kick in? What are some of the things that go into it? How is it different from a DNR, for instance? You know, those are important considerations to be aware of. A DNR is very, very different. A do not resuscitate is very, very different than a living will. One is under no circumstances should you be resuscitated, and a living will may be, you know, if A and B and C apply, or A or B or C apply, whether it's a persistent vegetative state, is it end stage condition, is it a terminal condition, and how are those provisions, how are those terms defined? Those are things that we walk through with clients. In our forms, they tend to be more interactive. So we give clients the option whether they want, for instance, a living will to come about in the event that they're in a persistent vegetative state, end stage, or terminal condition. But they don't have to select all three of those options. They could select one or two or three. And
one way of dealing with that very complicated subject.
And Bill, this is Nate. We cannot hear you speak. I don't know if your phone line is on mute, but we cannot hear you.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. It was on mute. The thing that we should be concerned about on some of these important documents is to make sure that instead of overburdening this, the three issues that Jeffrey just raised, vegetative state and those kinds of things, you just can't start a conversation by throwing those things out. You really need to ask clients what their desires are, and that's how you can raise those particular issues, because laying out the various alternatives does not really give them a foundation to talk about.
That's right, and I will also mention another thing that I discuss that I mentioned with clients. You know, to me, the living will is to provide instructions and guidance for your healthcare surrogate. Ultimately, your healthcare surrogate makes the decisions on behalf of the individual when it comes to whatever the medical conditions are. The living will is intended to provide guidance for that healthcare surrogate so that the healthcare surrogate knows that if these conditions are in place, that life prolonging procedures are to be withheld. And then you also can go into the different related themes. Is there going to be continuity of water? Should water be continued or withheld? Should food be continued and withheld? I've had clients that didn't want to pass away. They didn't want to expire by reason of hydration because they felt it may be painful. I've never had a client that wanted food but not water, but I suppose that's possible. But those are, you know, it's good to have, whereas a healthcare surrogate is really just, here's what it says and you can sign. Our living wills tend to be more interactive, giving clients the ability to select certain things or not initial others. And we even have a section in there for organ donation, which, you know, can be in furtherance of whatever they have in their driver's license, you know, if they're an organ donor. So there are different ways that you can draft it. But it, your theme, I think the takeaway from today is it's okay to separate these things out. Have a separate power of attorney, have a separate healthcare surrogate, separate living will, and special instructions for interment if that's important, as opposed to kind of blending those things in with, you know, all together or you know, putting it elsewhere.
And turning to some of the human beings that have to help carry it out, it is important, as we mentioned earlier, to at least have the clients tell us the various various people that may be involved: children, grandchildren. You know, it's always interesting. A client that walks in, newly married, they're talking about their parents being successor trustees. By age 45, they're now talking about siblings, and by age 70, you're talking about their children. So you always have to keep up to date. And, you know, it's very interesting when you say you want to do a healthcare surrogate. Oh, well, it clearly ought to be my son, the doctor. Well, that's not necessarily always the best choice if their son, the doctor, lives 700 miles away. He should be consulted, of course. So you really have to think through what makes sense for the family. And those considerations are important not only for healthcare matters, but if you look on page 12, just for the basic trust instruments that you may have, trying to identify the fiduciary that's going to handle the financial assets. Who should do it? Do you have one, two, or three people do it? Do you have a bank to act as fiduciary? And there's no right answer or wrong answer. And interestingly, I mentioned earlier before about the condominium that the elderly couple, the living trust makes a huge difference to make sure that there's money available to carry out all those plans. So your documents have to really be coordinated. I think that some of the things that if you look on page 13 about healthcare directive triggers, those were the items that Jeff was talking about. And it's really important, as he mentioned, to go through the various sets of circumstances that may arise, vegetative state, not ever being able to survive the current situation where doctors say there's no hope, if you will. Think those through in terms of what the client wants, and it's obviously not an easy conversation. Lots of clients don't want to talk about it at all. And the last thing you want to do is to run the client off. It's a good thing that they actually get to your office to talk about these things. One of the things that we should think about, and it's particularly important for a practice in Florida, is that a lot of clients live in two states. And they may be a resident in one state, but if they're somewhere else, it's questioned whether or not you should have some of these kinds of documents that comply with the other state's laws. There's not a set answer one way or the other, but that's something very much to think about. The last thing you want is to be in a state that really doesn't follow Florida law and get into an argument with a hospital administrator about whether they're going to follow through with everything. And it's always very important, if you are a lawyer in one state but not a lawyer in the other state, very important to get co-counsel. You don't want to import your documents in another state that may be very different. And when all is said and done, we're dealing with the lives of the clients on this. Jeff, did you want to go through some of the issues on 14 about guardians and conservators and trustees?
Yeah, definitely. Thanks, Bill. Let me start with guardianship. When you have a guardianship situation arise, it is important to remember that there are different components to that. One is, one may be a guardianship over the person, the other may be guardianship over the property. There is that has different implications for the ancillaries that may be in place. So if an individual has a healthcare surrogate, for instance, or power of attorney, guardianship may affect both of those instruments. May affect both of those documents, or the court may view that and say, you know what, those are sufficient substitutes for guardianship. Let's have it run through that instead, or it may suspend the power of attorney and enable the healthcare surrogate to continue on a moving forward basis. A lot of it is dependent on the applicable state law and also what the facts and circumstances are. Among the ancillaries that we prepare on a regular basis is something called a pre-need guardian, which enables our clients to select who might serve in a guardianship capacity should the need arise in the future. We couple that by telling our clients this is probably the least likely document that we prepare that you're going to sign today that will ever come up, because a lot of what we do in putting these pieces in place are specifically intended to avoid guardianship. And one of the things that you hear very often, very frequently, is the special need to avoid probate. And I think that's a little bit of a misnomer. It's nice to avoid probate, but I think you really want to avoid guardianship whenever possible.
Essentially, guardianship are actually when somebody really is unable to take care of themselves, and now at some level, if there's a family dispute, a judge has to deal with it. And there's nothing wrong with judges, but if there's something that's important that needs to be done in the next 20 minutes, a judge isn't going to be there at your beck and call.
That's right. And a good, you know, an estate plan that includes the things that we covered would ensure that guardianship is not needed unless you've got a family dispute. A good example of that could be naming multiple healthcare surrogates, and you know they just can't agree, and so you need a judicial intervention at that point through a guardianship proceeding.
Let me just add a couple of things on guardianships. It's particularly an expensive proposition if you don't use a pre-need guardian, where the person actually names the guardian. If absent that kind of document, various relatives, various children can have a fight, and even if they don't have a fight, it costs $5,000 or $10,000 to get an expert to say that this person has the capacity to be a guardian. If you have a pre-need guardian, you don't go through that that waste of time, effort, and money.
That's right. There are other thoughts that go into this discussion also. I started my discussion, my focus on guardianship and how that may come about. But you can also have a well laid out plan with a trust and a healthcare surrogate. And sometimes the trustee and the healthcare surrogate don't see eye to eye. And especially you certainly encounter this at times when you're dealing with a professional trustee, either a trust company or just an individual who's serving in that role with experience in those issues, and a family member that's serving as a healthcare surrogate. There may be some financial considerations that go into some of the medical treatments that are either being made or that aren't being made. You may have a trustee that feels that additional care should be warranted, or that the person should be, should continue to live at home with 24/7 care. And then the healthcare surrogate saying, no, I don't feel like that's necessary, or vice versa. And the vice versa is probably even more likely, because you know, the healthcare surrogate may not have the power of the purse, but the trustee does. And then you have a back and forth between the trustee and the healthcare surrogate about what are acceptable expenses that should be made in furtherance of this particular individual. And so these are things that come up not only where the grantor is involved, the grantor of a trust, but it could also be as a beneficiary. You could have a situation where there's a sub-trust created for a beneficiary, and among the things that are provided for are health, you know, health care decisions and expenses, and you've got this back and forth between the trustee of a trust and the individual's caregiver or healthcare surrogate, trying to identify what the most logical and sensible approach is, and sometimes everyone's on board, and other times they're not. And so, you know, as lawyers, we are sometimes, you know, we're known as counselors. I think we're also known as prognosticators
and
psychiatrists, and also, what can we see for the future? Can we, you know, what do we expect and what do we anticipate and what might happen? And trying to project what could arise in the future is a zero sum game. You can just try to, you know, to come up with different scenarios, but you'll never fully know exactly what the future holds. And so sometimes knowing and understanding your client's family dynamics will lend itself to that, you know, to those decisions in the future. And so it is important on some level as the attorney to get to know the family through the eyes and experiences of the client that you're serving.
And it's very difficult sometimes for clients to express themselves because they really haven't thought about them. It's very difficult to say, John, please tell us all the alcoholics that are in your family. I don't think that that's a very good way of starting off a conversation. On the other hand, if we're talking about who to name, as people that have fiduciary responsibilities, it's going to be pretty important to focus on those persons in terms of their capacity, mental capacity, honesty, and those kinds of things. And you just can't ask the question simply. The best way, as I find it, is for lawyers to talk not very much and allow the clients to talk. I know it's that talk's easy, but it's hard to do. Try to find, in my view, to get clients to communicate if they're new clients of yours. Try to find common ground that both of you have shared interests, and that is a way of building on the relationship, and that is very helpful. One of the things that we haven't discussed, which goes hand in hand with some of these documents, is the potential for a business that's involved, and how is the business going to be managed, even though it has nothing to do with healthcare, except for the fact that if your client is the chief executive officer and he's the one that has a heart attack or a stroke, who is going to carry it on? I know it has nothing to do with healthcare, but these are health issues. So part of the discussion that you have when you're dealing in estate planning and dealing with these kinds of things is really to know the health of not only your clients, but all the other people that they're thinking of naming.
Yeah. Those are really, you know, hopefully everyone's starting to see kind of the details, but also the big picture. I mean, there's a lot at play when you talk about ancillaries and some of the specific details, and then the bigger picture. And family dynamics is certainly a big picture. Understanding the finances, the structure, and what's involved as part of that process. I think, you know, as the reality is, we have we will have an aging population. You know, in the future, you're going to have more instances of guardianships that arise because you don't have. Not everyone has documents in place. Interestingly enough, clients may actually have documents in place. Bill mentioned, you know, his husband and wife with three kids. I will tell you, what if the client is unmarried or a widow and doesn't have any kids? You know, if they are in need of medical care, the people that they may have documents in place. But the lawyer may not know that the client is in need of medical care, and the individuals who are named may not know. And so what I think is important as kind of a backstop to all of this is there is definite significance in sharing healthcare surrogates. To me, I tell clients, share it with everybody. You know, I mean, just you know, have at it. Send it to anyone and any, you know, include it with your holiday cards next year. Because we don't have a central database that, you know, a hospital can look up and say, okay, I've got all of this information here's the patient and these are the people that we need to contact, you know, to make medical decisions. Now, this wasn't as critical an issue before HIPAA. And HIPAA is a wonderful device. It's a wonderful thing. It's you know, it's something that it is important from the standpoint of privacy. Obviously, I think everyone is aware of what HIPAA does. You know,
or not, right?
But it also has created some fundamental problems when it comes to enabling medical providers to make quick decisions. And a lot of the decisions that need to be made, especially with an aging population, have to be made quickly. Somebody's carted away. And remember what I said earlier also with a healthcare surrogate. It is when you are incapacitated. So by definition, the person is incapacitated and they're being rushed to the hospital. Who can act on their behalf? And so giving advanced copies of that healthcare surrogate to your medical provider, to the hospital, if you know if it's if it's if you've been there in the past, then they could keep one on record. If you go in for a procedure, oftentimes people will sign paperwork to that effect, but this is more in the, from the standpoint of an emergency. Even the best laid plans can blow up in smoke if nobody is aware that the fancy documents that you prepared even exist.
And that's why it's important that clients know and hopefully remember that they are going in for a procedure, and instead of signing the one-page document that the hospital gives you and says fill it out, it may not have the same kinds of language that, they thought through all the way, and we could just send the copies over or provide it to their doctor, their physicians.
Bill, why don't we transition and have you talk a little bit about availability and financing of home health care and institutional care. Kind of fits in a little bit with what we were just discussing.
That clearly is, it's on page 17, and that clearly is something that we could spend about 3 hours on. Obviously, health insurance is critical. America is not the easiest place anymore about trying to figure out what healthcare is going to look like in 2018. But at least in terms of elderly people, Medicare is certainly a very critical kind of feature, and that's it. There are experts out there that specialize in elder care and know the ins and outs of Medicare. Poor people are in the Medicaid area, and Medicaid is. It's for young and old. It's not age based. Let me talk about, if you will, long term care insurance. That is one of those things that when clients come in and they're 35 or 40, that's probably the best time to actually talk about long term care insurance, because that's probably as inexpensive as you're going to get. The older you get, the more expensive it is, and it may not. Be very helpful. I'll try to give it in maybe 90 seconds. There are two main components for long-term care insurance: the dollar amount a year of how much the insurance is, and the other factor is, do you want those payments made at a particular duration, for 1 year, 2 year, 5 years? And a lot of it really depends on one factor, and that is, how much do you want to spend? And the reason why I say that is that the larger the amount, the more expensive it is. The longer you have the coverage, the more expensive it is. And therefore, we should reflect on your clients, and they really need to get the advice from a responsible insurance person. But by and large, people who get sick do not live on for a long time. On the other hand, if there's a family history of Alzheimer's, there's a likelihood that it will be a long time. So you really have to try to do the best you can with a family that may have limited resources as to what you're dealing with and what those choices are. It's not easy, and at some level, it's a guessing game, but those are two critical features to think about. Every community is different, so trying to find place to go, I will tell you that lots of clients, if you ask any client that's 40 or 50 years old, the immediate reaction is, I have no interest in being in a nursing home. The interesting thing is, elderly clients are pretty much the same way. But the real issue sometimes are the care. If a couple is fortunate enough that husband and wife live a long time, and one gets sick, the burden on the other becomes huge to take care of it. So there are lots of circumstances that make it really difficult for families to deal with. And as a lawyer, you probably have more information about clients to at least raise the issues and talk with them. So let's move on to the very important subject of healthcare providers and trustees.
Yeah, I just picking up on that theme.
Okay.
I think that long-term care insurance is frankly, it's a topic that I discuss with almost all of my estate planning clients, and I've done so ever since I would say about 8 years ago. I had an estate of a very successful local attorney. Who passed away with an estate that was not particularly large, and I spoke with the with his family about the assets and whatnot, and discovered that the decedent's mom was 106 years old, and she had two sons, and both sons had been providing for her care over the course of maybe 25 years since their father passed away. And the mom at 106 had effectively depleted her husband's estate, her estate, and both sons' future, one was still alive, one had passed away as my client, had depleted all of the estates. And it was remarkable to me. And the sons did not have the heart to put her in a Medicaid facility, even though she would have qualified, because they felt that it would have killed her. And so, ever since then, I've been more inclined to discuss long-term care as an option. I don't push it. I explain it, and I'll even, give examples of things that I've encountered and seen and what some of the benefits are, but it really is a cost-benefit assessment.
I think it's important to make sure that they go see somebody who is an expert.
Yeah,
and that's
absolutely agree. Yeah, and that is actually my recommendation. It's typically, if they're already working with a financial advisor or insurance provider, I will always steer them back to that individual. And oftentimes, those are the same people that, may have even referred the matter to you. So it's a good way to stay engaged and involved in that process while serving a benefit for your client. But there is another component to this that ties in with something I talked about earlier, and that is the give and take that you have from a trustee standpoint and a healthcare surrogate that's trying to make decisions on behalf of the same individual. Long-term care insurance can mitigate a lot of this stress, especially from a financial standpoint, and can help subsidize those costs so that you're not fully depleting a trust in order to pay for these expenses, that instead you've got other forms of income that are coming in from a long-term care policy. And serving that role and serving that benefit. I have one. I mean, I started when I was 38.
The right time.
And whether it was the right decision or not, I guess I'll find out in over the course of my life, or maybe I won't even know. But it's with everything else in life. Insurance is
one of the insurance that you don't want to collect on.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And you're rolling the dice. And it's there, I guess, just in case, which is, the just in case is probably another nice way of saying the word insurance.
Yes. Right.
But these are things that can mitigate some of the stress and some of the financial considerations. In drafting trusts, just as a kind of related theme, when I draft revocable trusts, I typically include a provision in the trust instrument that provides a preference for home health care. I will include it in the trust so that it's clear to everybody that my clients prefer to stay at home for as long as they can. you know, I may eventually work with a client that wants to go to a nursing home. Maybe the food is good there. You know,
I've not heard anybody say that yet.
I mean, there will always be a first for everything. But most prefer to have that home care, and regular insurance may cover regular medical issues, hospital visits and whatnot, but it's not going to cover 24/7 nursing care. It's not going to cover certain, you know, other things that either insurance or Medicare or Medicaid is not otherwise
right.
covering. Now, granted, if it's Medicaid, we're out of this discussion altogether because you're not going to have a long-term care policy and Medicaid. But from a Medicare or from a trust financing perspective, this is long-term care is often a good approach, although it comes with some caveats. Bill mentioned the cost as being a caveat. I've also heard over the years that insurance companies have been pulling out of this arena,
sure.
and that is reducing some of the available options and which, you know, has the unfortunate benefit of, well, not benefit, burden of increasing the cost while diminishing some of those returns. So these are personal decisions, but definitely something that should be discussed in the big picture of it and how it and where the interplay is, either from a trustee standpoint and a healthcare surrogate, or and even if it's one and the same, even if you've got the same person serving as a trustee or power of attorney and healthcare surrogate, they still have, you know, fiduciary obligations and responsibilities. And so this could be a good way to help facilitate that and both the cooperation, eliminate conflict or potential conflict, but also supplement those important medical expenses that most clients, in the future may want to have and may have wished they had they only discussed it sooner.
And sometimes you have to be alert to raise the issues, or you hear about it when they're 60, and then something happens 10 years later that they mention it, and you have to have it in your brain, oh, yes, we sort of talked about that a while ago, whatever that issue is. And you just need to always think through the client's wishes. It's estate planning is difficult.
You mentioned the word expression. You mentioned the word wishes, and it reminds me of the client that you touched on earlier, the one that I met with yesterday for a signing. The client that I met with had this interesting. You know, she sent me in advance of our signing. She sends me a 3-page document that goes through what she calls an expression of wishes. And I have to say, I really liked it. I hadn't seen anything quite like this before, where it just kind of gave this overview of what, you know, she would want her caregiver to do. Granted, by the way, this is a 38-year-old client who's also a physician, whose name obviously will remain anonymous. But she really put some thought into this, and I think it's something that I may actually incorporate moving forward. Hopefully she won't ask me for any, you know, copyright payments or royalties. But it's things like, you know, things that are just routine, like I wish to be cared for with kindness and cheerfulness and not sadness. I wish to be read from my favorite books. Or have pictures of loved ones. I want to be kept in a comfortable state, and there's 3 pages of this. So what I did for her was I added it as a more of a legal document, but I made clear that if there's a conflict between this expression of wishes and any of the other documents that we were preparing, you know, that I call the ancillaries, that the ancillaries would control, but that these should be read as broadly as possible to effectuate that intent. And there's some interesting dynamics to that. It is something that kind of fits in with everything else that we talk about, having an expression of wishes can give the individual the ability to communicate things that in the future they may not be able to communicate.
I think I want to have a copy and show it to I teach estate planning. I start next week as the first class. I think I'd like to do that just to give them a thought. I teach at one of the law schools here, Stetson, and they have an elder law certification program, so estate planning is mandatory. This would be ideal for them to have.
Yeah, and I just think it's a good thing for all of you listeners to even consider. Until just, you know, this past week, wasn't really on my radar. But now that I see it, it's kind of interesting. I like it.
And I think as we're going to wind down on the time, and I know that we'll be hearing now, but I suggest that if you have questions, please, you know, let the operator know that you have questions, and we're happy to answer them at this time. And if you wish to ask a question, press the star key on your touchtone phone, followed by the one key, and that's star one. And when you do, you will be told your place in line. To get out of the queue, just press the pound sign. When prompted for your question, please be brief. And anyway, Jeff, what do you think of the potential for conflicts when you are aware that three children don't get along for whatever reason, and parents have in their head that they want to treat their children equally and assign them to be co-trustees, whether or not they get along and whether or not they have talents? What do you do?
Well, you know, with three, if it's from the standpoint of a trust, you know, as a trust instrument, if you've got three trustees, a majority typically rules unless your trust provides otherwise. Where you have two kids that are at odds, the best advice you could give them is don't appoint either of them. Or you could appoint each of them as the trustee of their separate subtrust after both parents pass away. But while the parents are alive, you know, take them out of the equation if they can't get along. Because whatever happens, there's going to be some conflict there. Now, who you name in their place creates other issues, because that may create other conflicts between the kids, one or both kids or all three kids, and the individual that's named to serve in that role.
They resign because he doesn't want to be bothered with it.
He or she, right.
The reason why I asked that question, Jeffrey, let us suppose you have a client that brings in their mother to do their estate plan, and you've represented this client, and you know that when you were doing your client's plan, she couldn't stand her brother and her sister. But your client comes in with the mother to do her will. What do you do?
You know, you have to make an assessment. As whenever I meet with a client and their son or their daughter, I always try to make an assessment of my own as to what the client's mental state is like. Are they there with their son or their daughter because their mental issues that prevent them from, you know, from understanding things and communicating effectively, or is it just, you know, to have somebody there for comfort, or maybe even just to drive? When that situation arises, it's also important to really, you know, this kind of fears a little bit from our discussion in certain respects, but you can definitely tie it back in from a healthcare perspective. Is there a push to have one child, you know, perhaps the one that's there, mm-hmm. serve in a role that is an expansion of what was in existence before. That's also kind of a potential red herring. And if that is the case, what I will almost always do in instances where I feel like there's a potential conflict like that is I will gently ask the non-client to please, you know, sit in the waiting room, just so that I could preserve it for the record and for, you know, preserve attorney-client privilege, and also in some ways protect the other child so that I've got documentation that over the course of these discussions they were not present. And then when I have complete privacy with the client, at that point just, you know, ask the questions and make my own assessment as far as, you know, whether they're making their decisions under any influence, and with full capacity. So it really is a touchy-feely thing, and you can apply it both from a financial standpoint, but also obviously from a medical standpoint.
If we're fortunate enough that your client has called you to say, "Can you take care of my mother's will?" The best thing to do on that phone call is to say, and of course, if you bring her in, don't be surprised if I tell you to wait out in the hall, so you shouldn't be surprised and you don't get angry, because that's for your benefit, let alone your mother's benefit.
Yeah.
So, and if your client knows in advance why you're doing it, it doesn't cause a problem. Frankly, the parent may be lost, if you will, in some fashion that she was counting on it. Yeah. So it's a good idea to plan for it that way. But I don't think it's a good idea to have one child in the room at the same time, especially if there's a fight. And you never know, even if there isn't a fight, whether there might be a fight later on.
Yeah.
So, I think that we haven't heard anybody that had any questions. So I want to thank. So I thank everyone for listening to us today, and that's all the time we have. If you were not able to ask your question or one occurs to you, please contact either me or Jeff. Our contact information is on the front of the materials, and call us or email us at any time. We're happy to help out. Thank you very much, and thank you, Jeff.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Take care.
Take care.
On behalf of the Professional Education Broadcast Network, thank you for listening. This concludes today's teleseminar. You may all disconnect.